Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First up in our show, we're going to hear from Brooke Leifso. She'll be telling us a little bit about her research into disabilities in the performing arts. So tell me a little bit about the project.
So this project, the Performing Arts Theater Research Project, is that what you'd like?
Yes.
Okay. So the Performing Arts the Performing Arts Accessibility Research Project is looking at what Edmonton communities want for accessibility to remove barriers for them seeing performing arts. And then we're also contacting artists as well. So artists who experience disabilities or other barriers to see how they may particularly need things as well. And the goal behind it for the ad hoc consortium is what they call themselves, which is, I would say, a dozen performing art companies in the city, is so that they can make their work more accessible. So it's a really local-based project that's just looking at how to get more community interaction and more inclusion.
So what are some of the common barriers faced by a performance artist with a disability?
A performance artist with a disability? I would say accessible venues is a big one. There's still spaces in the city that have stairs that go up to them and very narrow back hallways and narrow dressing rooms. The Citadel Theater, which is our regional theater, is renovating their bathrooms to accommodate this. They have hired an actor for an upcoming show who uses a chair, and so they need to renovate their bathrooms. So that's probably the biggest, is for an artist, is having barrier-free performance space.
So have there been any challenges in the research specifically?
In the research component, I would say we're starting our focus groups today, and I'm not sure how many people are coming out because the barriers that present themselves to performing arts, ironically, can also present themselves to people coming to other events. So that would be one barrier. I would also say another barrier is that the study has a really wide scope. So we have included capital B deaf folks in the study to figure out accessibility for them, but we also understand that that community may not identify with the word disabled. So some of that complexity of disability politics comes into the study as well.
So what are you hoping to achieve with the research overall?
Well, I would say as a performer and a producer that experiences disability and has been doing this work on, and Kelsey as well, she's the other researcher. What we're hoping for is just more access and a more inclusive performing arts community for audience, for everyone. That's the main goal. What else could I say to that? I think it is just to have art be more accessible and near the community that it's in.
So, if you could send any message to the community about why this is important, what would you say?
Which community? The disability community or the performing arts community?
Actually, just in general, speaking to anyone with an interest in these matters.
Yeah. I think what I would say is it's exciting to be part of a shift to see more diversity represented in our arts in Canada, and that's an exciting thing to be part of, looking at how to do that and what adaptations need to occur. And I hope that we see more differing bodies and stories on stage and audiences. And I'm a huge proponent of performing arts for the fact that it's real people getting together at a singular time to sit in a room and witness something. That's something that the performing arts can do that other medias can't do. And so how can we do that in a way that engages conversation with everyone and makes everyone feel safe and welcome? And this is one way that Edmonton is attempting to do that.
So, if you don't mind my asking, since you mentioned you yourself have a disability,
mm-hmm.
can you tell me a little bit about your story?
Sure. So I experienced disability through my cerebral palsy diagnosis, but since learning the social model as an adult, I mostly say I experienced disability through lack of access to affordable health insurance or any health insurance at times, and driving. Edmonton is a hugely car-focused city, as I'm sure Windsor is too, given your history. And so that's one way every day I experience disability. My own story is I was born in rural Ontario, and probably every day of my life, I've engaged in some conversation with myself or family or society about my body. And I really wanted to be in theater and acting probably since I was 9-10 years old, and just auditioning for things and really knowing that at that time that my body wasn't really experiencing like constant correction in that space, and then moving to producing and how to just make spaces safe for all bodies and all types and all sizes is really important to me. Growing up, my parents were very insistent that I be as able-bodied and adapt as much as possible. The biggest story I remember from that is we had stairs leading into our basement that didn't have a railing, and I mustered up the courage to ask for a railing to be put in. My parents said, no, you'll have to get used to the stairs without railing. So that's a story from my childhood. And then I really held that until I was about 20 and in school. And I just finally said, no, I don't want this. And so I was in a TA program in drama, and I just said, like, I don't want to constantly be thinking about my own safety on stairs, on railings, and I'm fairly able-bodied. I have mild cerebral palsy. And that was kind of the beginning of my journey of really understanding my disability for myself. And so in 2013, I did an artist in residence with The Haven on Gabriel Island, and spent a month building an art piece called Unraveling the Disabled. And I really looked at how my disability affected my personality and my sexuality, and how all of that was combined together. And since then, I've, since 2013, been working with the disability arts community in my own city and just building art in that way, as well as in the mainstream spaces. I think that would be more of my journey.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Not at all. This next segment of our show, we'll get an update from Lisa Gosman, who will be telling us a little bit about ostomies. So, you yourself have been affected by an ostomy. Can you tell me a little bit about your story?
Yes, when I was about 14 years old, I started becoming symptomatic for what turned out to be Crohn's disease. At the time, it was unknown what my problem was because I had grown up in a small town. In the 80s, when I was symptomatic, Crohn's disease was relatively still unheard of where I lived. So at age 15, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease and lived with severe pain, nausea, fatigue, bleeding through the stools, weight loss for a couple of years. And then when I was 16, I was actually diagnosed with Crohn's disease, started on medications. Unfortunately, I was one of the patients who medications such as steroids did not really work for me, so surgery was needed. I had ostomy surgery when I was 19. At the time, the term was quite unknown to me. I'd never even heard the term, didn't know anybody who had an ostomy.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the diagnosis process, how they determined that it was Crohn's?
For me, it was a relatively quick diagnosis once I got into the proper healthcare hands. It was a colonoscopy, basically, that was able to diagnose it pretty immediately on site. I do know a lot of friends who have Crohn's disease that the diagnosis process is significantly longer with CAT scans, MRIs, ultrasounds, but the procedure that usually actually gives the official diagnosis is the colonoscopy.
So, after the surgery, can you tell me a little bit about what were some of the greatest supports in your recovery?
For me, at the time, it was my boyfriend, who became my husband, my family. Outside of those people, I really didn't have any support, as opposed to now, if I had gone through ostomy surgery in this day, you know, in 2000, even 2000, I would have been able to learn about the Ostomy Canada Society, and one of their main mandates is to provide support. Unfortunately, I just wasn't aware of the organization in the 80s.
So, are there any myths or stereotypes concerning having an ostomy that you'd like to clear up?
There most certainly are. It's become more talked about, but for so many years, up until just the past few years even, it's been quite stigmatized because poop and pee really are taboo topics. People just don't like to talk about them. It's awkward. It can be embarrassing. It's a sensitive topic, but there's no need for that. Everybody does it. So some of us just do it differently. The stigma around it can be quite harsh and quite isolating, quite stigmatizing. It's having an ostomy is a life-saving surgery, but it's also a life-altering surgery that can significantly impact your body image, your self-esteem.
So what message would you send to all those out there who are still struggling with the concept?
I think the main thing is that having an ostomy enables people. It is not disabling. Quite often, people such as myself who have been so sick for so long, whether it's any form of IBD, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, those are the main reasons why people end up having to have ostomy surgery. They've become so trapped in their homes because of the urgency to have to use the bathroom. So once you have the ostomy surgery and you actually have the appliance on you, which has to be on you at all times, you cannot not have the appliance on you, you aren't so tied to the bathroom because you're kind of wearing your own bathroom in a sense. So it's it really is quite freeing, and we just need to become more socially aware. We need to talk about it more. We need to bring society further than we've already come, and we're making great strides.
So once a person does have the surgery and they find this freedom, do you think their presence in the community has the effect of opening eyes that this is just as valid as any other medical situation?
It does if people talk about it. The great thing about having an ostomy is nobody knows. You don't wear it on the outside of yourself. It's not written on your forehead that you have an ostomy. It's hidden beneath your clothes, which can be also then becomes one of those invisible illness situations. So unless we actually talk about it, then we aren't raising the awareness. We need to put ourselves out there, have the discussions, make sure that we are taking those fears away from the public.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4!
December 22nd, CJAM will be celebrating our 10th annual Joe Strummer Day Marathon. Kicking off at midnight, CJAM will be honoring the life of the former Clash frontman by playing 24 hours of music from Joe Strummer and the Clash, as well as interviews, reports, and calls to action surrounding poverty and homelessness in Windsor and Detroit. Celebrate Joe Strummer's life and his passionate fight against depression and poverty on December 22nd with CJAM 99.1 FM on the dial and online at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Lisa Gosman about her story of ostomy life, and from Brooke Leifso about her research into disabilities in the performing arts. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear a little bit about academics and disabilities from Abigail Parrish Craig. So tell me a little bit about your work surrounding disabilities.
I work at a university in Alberta, and my role title is counselor / chair, services to students with disabilities. And in these roles, I am a leader in a department that is mandated to ensure that students with disabilities have access to legislated accommodations, but has also shifted its focus to encouraging the university to facilitate access at all levels and in all ways to make the university experience more accessible for individuals who live with disability.
So, what are some of the most common barriers facing a student?
So the barrier identification is definitely an individual process, and so I'm always a bit cautious to overgeneralize, but the most commonly requested accommodation due to barriers is related to exam writing, and often it is the matter of time, the amount of time available. And that's also an experience that many individuals with disabilities find, that they generally require a bit more time than is expected of others to write, to read, take notes, study. It all varies from person to person, though. But probably that's the main thing where we are accommodating, is the barrier of time constraint.
Now, you were saying you wanted to make sure at all levels these rights and accommodations are respected. Can you take me through what some of the levels where it's necessary to look at this might be?
Okay. So I think the most obvious is the area of physical accessibility. So the architecture and design of the physical environment has probably taken the lead in terms of pushing expectations for barrier-free design and accessible design. And we're, as a campus, we are doing fairly well on that front. There's always a few less than perfect aspects of our design. So, like, sometimes when the power doors sometimes freeze up during cold weather, for example. So that becomes what's making the campus accessible becomes inaccessible at the pretty much the worst possible time for someone who's a wheelchair user. But so physical accessibility is typically the first thing we look at. The other levels are, from my perspective, are communications. So ensuring that all communications with the community and the group of people that the university either serves and or includes, that includes faculty and staff, that all communications are in a format that is accessible as well. So this is thinking of the person on campus who might have a reading disability for whatever the reason is, or might not be able to see print, that everything is available in an electronic format that can be converted easily to a text-to-speech format, at the very least. And the same with audio communications, to always be thinking about the user who might not be able to hear or who doesn't perhaps share the same language, so ensuring things like captioning in all audio communications. Those are often designed for people with disability for access reasons specifically, but evidence suggests that there are many people in our community who benefit from those types of presentation of materials. So that's important. And the other areas are service units or any office be prepared for a person with any type of medical condition or perceptual disability or mobility disability to be coming to visit them and be ready and accessible to welcome them and not have to run around and fix everything so that they can have a clear path of travel or whatever, right? So it's the designing the service to expect and welcome diversity.
So that brings up an interesting point. It's impossible to be prepared for every contingency, every type of disability. However, what it sounds to me like what you're doing is just making it as inclusive as possible, just covering as many bases as can realistically be foreseen.
That's right.
So
that's right. And anticipate. Like, I think that's my main message, is don't be surprised when someone who has a disability arrives, right? Because they're part of the they are part of the community of our society, of the university community. So just be thoughtful, like proactive in thinking about that, right? It's totally fine to have to make some minor adjustments and so on, but just not to make a big deal about them either as well. It's like, okay, we have a easy fix for that.
So in your time working with students with disabilities, what's been the greatest success that you've witnessed?
That is obviously a little bit hard to pinpoint, but I think it's that more individuals feel comfortable identifying that they are experiencing barriers now than they did in the past. So and for the most part, that applies to individuals who are living with what might be considered an invisible disability or a chronic medical condition, or there's lots of things that fall under that category, that more and our work has shifted from primarily working with students with visible and more kind of visibly obvious disabilities to people living with invisible disabilities. And I think that's a really good sign that people are starting to feel more comfortable identifying themselves and getting to a place of feeling more empowered and deserving of full access. When many have historically gone without because of complicated reasons, mostly stigma and or perceived negative attitudes towards them.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In life, my friends, learning about disabilities does not stop with a degree. It's not something you leave at the office at night. It's something that you carry with you wherever you go, whatever you do. You learn, you grow, you come to understand the human face behind a condition. And you do this by keeping your eyes, your ears, and your hearts open, not to mention your minds. Truth is, anybody can sit there and listen to a statistical model of disability may affect this, it may affect that, it may affect this many people. But does that tell you anything about the person? Does that tell you anything about the story that led up to it? Does it tell you, does this person have a family, a job, an education, dreams? Did they lead what some would call, quote-unquote, a normal life, right up until one moment redefined them? Were they born that way? These are the questions you have to ask. And you can't just assume what a person will need. Saying nothing about us without us, it's incredibly appropriate, I think. Because no matter what it is, you need the contrast of voices. You need people coming together to find common ground, to find solutions. Might not work for everyone in every situation, but if we keep our minds, our hearts, and our senses open, we can recognize the problems facing accommodation and facing transportation, equality in the workplace. These aren't as big of a challenge as we like to think. What do we as a society do? We like to make things complicated. We like to look upon these issues as too big for us to solve, so we can wash our hands and expect somebody else to do it. That is a very human tendency. But at some point, somebody somewhere has to say, I want to be a part of this change. I want to be a part of the movement going forward. Abigail was absolutely right when she said, the shift is happening between our narrow focus of simply physical conditions. Yes, those are a big part of disability life, and yes, their needs must be taken into consideration. But it's not the whole show. It is not everything that needs consideration. It's not one size fits all. I mean, the more we look at the complexities, the human mind, the human body, and human capability, the more we come to understand that it is an incredibly diverse topic. And people, they can either be ruled by their condition, the idea that it's too daunting to ever change, or say, I'm going to change it, even if it's only in my very small way. So, you get those voices together, you share ideas, you share resources. Before you know it, you actually have something that might actually make a difference. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me, folks, you've earned it. I'll see you next week.